Hello everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. This is Stefan Sasse, a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com, and with me, as always, is my very illustrious co-host,
Sean T. Collins. I am a TV critic who covers Game of Thrones and other shows for such publications as Rolling Stone, Vulture, and the New York Observer. I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones with series editor Anne Grohl, and The World of Ice and Fire and Westeros.org's Elio Garcia Jr. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones website located at boiledleather.com, the humble host of this not so humble podcast. And exciting news today, I guess, kind of. There's a new chapter from The Winds of Winter available at georgerrmartin.com. It went up, I believe, late last night and was kind of passed around this morning. It's an Arianne chapter that George has read at various convention stops, I guess, or it's in-store appearances. I'm not really sure, but I do remember having read not quite a transcript, but a pretty thorough description of it at some point. So I did have a little bit of deja vu as I was reading it. I was like, wait, don't we know some of this already? But there's actually quite a bit that we didn't know already, unless you had happened to come across one of those descriptions of the readings. So I say we just get right into it, Stefan.
Yeah, absolutely.
What's your main takeaway from this chapter?
Yeah, I mean, let's point out the obvious here. Storm's End has been taken by the Golden Company under Lord Conington. So it seems whatever his plan was that he stated in his final chapter in Dance with Dragons, it worked, obviously. No clue still how he did it. So that will be one interesting thing to unravel there, but definitely he took it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's possible that they're lying to Arianne, but I don't really see...
No.
Yeah, why would they do that? If the point is to lure her into their clutches, well, she's already in their clutches, so they don't really need to make up some story to get her to go someplace else. They could just capture her and take her there. You and I had to look up what the status of Storm's End was at the time that they would have conquered it, and it's interesting. It was being besieged by Mace Tyrell, but he left along with most of his forces when Margaery was arrested by the Faith. So he left I'm just reading straight up from a wiki of Ice and Fire. He left Lord Mathys Rowan behind to continue the siege. But inside Storm's End, there's still diehard Stannis loyalists, I guess primarily Stannis's uncle, Lomas Estermont, I guess.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how does Aegon cut through not one but two different opposing forces? I assume he recruited one.
Yes.
That's my guess. But which one?
I want to backtrack this just a little bit, because one additional detail I think to remember here is that the people left in Storm's End are Kingsmen. This might or might not be important, but they are definitely not the Rolorites, you know, not the religious fanatics. They are Stannis loyalists, and that might or might not be important, but I think we should note it here. And the second thing is that on the superb blog of the Wars and Politics of Ice and Fire, there is quite an extended argument being made about who will support the Golden Company. And their main argument runs that most of the Reach Lords are secret Blackfyre loyalists, which would explain quite a lot, actually. Because if Mathys Rowan is one of those people who has risen in many of the Blackfyre rebellions, especially in the first one, and is a secret loyalist to the cause, he might easily turn over the siege to the Golden Company and allow them to do whatever shenanigans they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So if one of those two forces yielded, it is certainly the Tyrells, or they simply surprised them and ran them over, because, again, it's only a token force. But Stannis loyalists, they have never given up, so why would they now that the Golden Company comes, right? So I think Mathys Rowan has changed sides.
Right. But still a question of how they break, you know, how you actually win a Siege of Storm's End without recourse to, like, a demon shadow baby. Because as best I can tell, that's never been done.
No, it hasn't been done. Like so many castles in Martin's lore, it has never fallen to siege. But again, Winterfell hasn't either. So my best guess is that the Golden Company guys did some kind of trick. And given that Cunnington is a Stormlander, he might just have intimate knowledge of some secret passage, because all those castles have secret passages. Mm-hmm. And by the way, this is also how I think some people will get into Winterfell later.
Yeah.
So it is very likely that they simply knew which levers to pull, so to speak, and where to get in, or where is a good spot to throw your grappling hooks where no one will see you for X minutes or whatever, you know, that they simply had one way. But the way in which Cunnington was talking about Storm's End in The Winds of Winter really suggested to me that he knows the equivalent of a secret passage. It was just so certain, you know, like, I know a way in.
Yeah, yeah.
Not like I have an idea and it is totally risky or whatever. No, no, I know a way in. So not paraphrase, only paraphrasing here, right? Not quoting. I think that's what they did.
It's very interesting that, well, I said interesting. Everyone who's paying attention to our long-running audience participation game, feel free to call me a piece of shit. I said interesting. But basically, what this means is Cunnington and Aegon are going to rely basically on sheer know-how and talent in terms of how they're going to get to the Iron Throne. They're not really playing politics by this standard. They're just going to, like, outfox and outfight people. At least that seems to me the strategy, which makes some sense. You know, the Golden Company, they're men of action, you know. They're not gonna scheme and marry their way to power. Although I assume a marriage proposal is at least in the offing. I'm just curious I don't recall what the Golden Company knows about the current status of Daenerys or Quentin Martell.
Nothing. I don't think they have actual current information. No. But I just did look up what the exact dialogue is. And so a guy named Mallow, I don't know who he is exactly, he says, if Storm's End is so impregnable, how did you mean to take it? And the answer is, by guile. So this suggests more or less that they're posing as someone they are not to be let in. So it might just be that they're overrunning Rowan Mathis token force, or staging a mock battle or whatever, and then posing as just, we rescued you, you know, like Ramsay did in Winterfell.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
Seems like it's a deliberate throwback here. So I guess poor Mathis Rowan, he will be missed.
Yeah. Oh, so now you're switching and saying he didn't convert Mathis Rowan to Blackfyre.
Might be, but I guess if he says by guile, that suggests that they want to pose as someone.
True, true. Or like you said, it's a matter of finding a way in, unbeknownst to other people.
Okay, but it will not be like the grappling hooks, I guess, because that's not
right,
guy.
Right. Well, I have to say, I gotta hand it to John Con here. Well done, sir. Well done.
Well done. Yes.
You know, you took Storm's End. That's quite a feat. I feel like there's a, you know, Storm's End and Winterfell, these two impregnable fortresses more or less falling in rapid succession. You know, I guess that's kind of what you have to do to move the story along when you're telling an epic fantasy saga. Yeah. But I think that's got to be disconcerting for the people of Westeros, and it sends sort of a thematic message about how unstable things are at this point.
Yeah.
You know, with the others waiting in the wings, everything's getting turned upside down, you know, and by all reasonable assumptions, that's going to continue. I think you're likely to see Old Town get sacked. I think you're likely to see blood in the streets of King's Landing again. You know, who knows what else? So, and it's funny. There's a way to read his release of an Arianne chapter right now as a sort of subliminal shot across the bow of the show, which is obviously handled Dorne much differently, but yeah. Up to and including the fact that Arianne doesn't exist, and neither does Quentin. Now
Or Aegon.
Now I'm usually reluctant to look at things like that, but I bring it up only because I think something similar is going on in the show right now in terms of projecting instability by having various things that are of a kind happen at once. You know, in the show right now, Ramsay Bolton has taken over the North. Ilaria Sand, who in her version in the show is a warmonger, has taken over Dorne. And Euron Greyjoy is poised to take over the Iron Island. So all of a sudden, you know, and then there's still this kind of three-way power struggle between Cersei and the Tyrells and the Faith Militant in King's Landing. So everything's, and then Walder Frey is in charge of the Riverlands. So most of Westeros is controlled by total pieces of shit. And I think there's an echo of that here. Or whatever you would call an anticipatory echo. I don't know. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to bring up is just how complex the power dynamics in the South are right now. When you look at what's going on here, you have the Tyrells, who are nominally allied with the Crown still, but basically at odds with the Crown, even though they're pretending not to be. But that's a delicate dance. Then you have Aegon and the Golden Company. You have the Dornish. There's a whole lot going, and you have the Lannisters. There's and the Faith Militant. That's like five major players at least, fighting for control of everything from King's Landing south. So there's so many. Arianne's really getting kind of pushed into the deep end of the politics pool here, considering how many different forces she has to keep in mind and how many different potential allies and enemies are at play.
I think what's happening here is the setup for the climax of the story, because right now the Tyrells and the Dornish and the Vale are the three regions in which you still have intact armies that are basically unscathed from the War of the Five Kings. So if the others attacked now, you would have those three armies as natural opponents, which would make for kind of lopsided storytelling, because those are the regions we basically have no POV access to. So those armies need to be destroyed. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at what is currently set up, those three armies will be destroyed, because the Tyrells and the Dornish and the Golden Company will first decimate each other's and then bear the brunt of Daenerys' initial attack, while the Vale, the Knights of the Vale, I guess they are pretty poised to go with Sansa in the north and be the first cannon fodder to be killed by the others' onslaught, which would then basically eliminate all... all organized military resistance and reduce the points of conflict to the northern defense line around Winterfell, where the final battle or one of the final battles against the others will take place, as we discussed already. There will be one major defense center in the south, most likely in Highgarden, against Euron Greyjoy's onslaught. And then we will have Daenerys on a burnt King's Landing, not knowing where to go next. And I think what we see here is the setup for this. You know, this taking of Storm's End is obviously something that Mace Tyrell can't ignore. So what we will see next is the whole Tyrell host marching again from King's Landing, where Margaery will by now most likely be dead from all the trial and Robert Strong and all that kind of stuff. So it will come down, there will be a battle, and of course Jon Con will win it, because why else introduce him, right? So that Aegon can sit the Iron Throne, marry Arianne Martell, the more beautiful younger queen, and then just in time, Dany will arrive and burn the whole place to cinders. And I think we can see this already. And if you look at the chapter once again, there is this scene in which pretty much in the beginning, in which the company is hiding out in the cave, and where the young sand snake, I already forgotten her name, she is hunting for fish. And Arian is
it's
giving
Ilya, I believe.
Ilya, yes. Yeah. And Arian is giving her a hard time, because she could have died in the cave. And if you look at it, you could have died, said Arian again. Her words echoed off the cavern walls. Died, died, died. This is pretty typical for Martin to foreshadow something here. Mm-hmm. Yes, you could have died, and you very well might in future, you know? And I guess, what we get here is kind of the mood setting and the plot setting both at the same time. This is the twilight, you know, the twilight before it really, the real stuff hits.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, I don't really presume to know the exact mechanics of how things will go down. You know, I think the takeaway is, like you said, there's going to be a lot of fighting between armies that would really be better off not fighting. there's also the Ironborn swimming around out there someplace too, who are going to necessarily draw forces away from, you know, various other conflicts, various other locales. You know, I can't imagine Euron Greyjoy not making a play for King's Landing itself when he gets the chance.
I don't think he will, but I guess
really?
I guess we will get to the Greyjoy arc in a future podcast. This will lead us too much astray. Yeah. But to get back to the point once again, of course, I also can't presume to know the concrete mechanics by which it will work. Mm-hmm. This is just one version, which I find pretty convincing, but of course it can turn out the other way. But from pure storytelling standpoint, can you really imagine 100,000 or 150,000 military force engaging the others in open pitched battle? That doesn't sound right for some reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. I'd kind of like to see it, but it does seem, you know, obviously the whole point, as we've said, you know, with regularity you could set your watch to, is that all the wars that people are fighting for petty political reasons or even serious political reasons are a distraction from the real fight. So what you could see, essentially, when all of these forces are kind of battered and reduced by, you know, fighting among themselves, is, one would assume, the Three Heads of the Dragon sort of rallying an all-star team of all the surviving forces from Westeros against the others. If you put a gun to my head, I would say that's where it's headed. You know, that all these people that have been fighting each other now have to work together. Maybe that's a little bit, you know, that's kind of corny, but I'm kind of a corny guy.
I don't think that will happen. I guess some of those conflicts were resolved before. For example, I don't think Aegon and John Connor long for this world.
No, me neither. Well, he's one of the pretenders that she has to get rid of, you know, according to
prophecy and all.
Yeah, right. Or at the very least, he's not going to be a factor.
Yes, and they won't ally with Euron. I will agree that basically all conflicting parties that we have met in the titular Game of Thrones, you know, in the first three books, those people will have to work together.
Yeah.
And this is where I agree. But we have now, with Feast Dance, progressed into a more metaphysical world, into a more metaphysical sphere of plot, where villains and protagonists have changed, and those guys are not exactly in the same boat. especially Euron, but some other people as well, you know, and those really won't work that well together.
True.
I think some of them are, if you allow for the Lord of the Rings comparison, they also don't manage to get Saruman into their lines.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't mean to suggest that I thought Euron or Ramsay are going to be any good in the fight to come. Or for that matter, Cersei. And I kind of, given the prophecy involving her fate, I don't know that Jaime will factor into the final battle either. But we are going pretty far afield here, I suppose. Maybe we should just talk about Arianne.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to be learning pretty well on the fly.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I thought it was very funny that she asked Daemon Sand, like, why would my father inflict Ilya Sand on me? And Daemon Sand's like, vengeance? Because I think that's what we all figured, you know, that she was saddled with this completely impossible person to teach her what it was like to be her dad all these years.
It's also really cool to see how she gets Ilya Sand in line, you know, swear it on the bones of your father. And she's like, yeah, well, you got me.
Right.
Really like a teenager, you know, you found my weak spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, and she's no dummy. I mean, she was kept in the dark, so she made a lot of bad decisions, but it's too bad. And you almost wish that Doran, or you do wish that Doran had the perspicacity to let her in on the secret earlier, particularly when Quentin left. That's when I would have done it. Because that's what really set her off. You know, she thought that her claim was going to be usurped, and that's what really brought everything to a head and led to the terrible plan with Darkstar and kidnapping and trying to crown Margaery, and everything's going to be all fucked up. So it's really, I think, on Doran not to have let her in on the secret earlier, because clearly she can be trusted and is a, you know, a fairly thoughtful, cautious leader when it's called for, which it is during this particular part of the mission.
Yes.
You know. So I don't know. My respect for her rose a great deal here, I guess. And it already had been rising in the previous sample chapters and in Dance, I guess. She just seemed like someone who realized where she went wrong and is working to not do that anymore, which is a trait I respect. So,
yeah, I can only agree. By the way, just to point to another of those small elements in this chapter that is really nice. A brimming of the place with the magic of the old gods. You know, the whole mm-hmm. description of the area they are traveling through is saturated in greens, you know, like in greensier.
Yep.
And then they are making camp at old weirwoods with faces.
Yeah, and there's a stone, like a stone weirwood, not a weirwood forest, but a stone forest, quote unquote, of columns with the faces of the old gods carved into it, which is something I don't think we've ever even heard of the Children of the Forest working in stone before, have we?
No.
I don't even think that's in the World of Ice and Fire. Maybe it might be, and I might just be forgetting. But that's very interesting to me that they have their own Stonehenge, essentially.
Hey, there are quite a lot of those little details. I also like this discussion between the Septon and the Maester about the nature of storms. And with the Septon going, "Yes, it's obvious the storm god's wrath can be seen everywhere," and not a Maester, Doran Martell basically saying like, "No, the winds are taking up moisture in the Septon. That's preposterous."
Right. Hey, the Septon's a bit of a this is kind of an interesting Septon, because he's vouching for the reality of gods other than the Seven.
Yeah, I also thought this was weird, but at the same time, of course, it reinforces the predominance of the Seven, because of course the old gods are all gone, so
that's true. Obviously, and it's true that until with exceptions, the faith of the Seven has been tolerant of other faiths. It's just weird to hear them like talking about it and taking it so seriously. But then again, perhaps he takes a syncretic approach, and that the storm god is just an aspect of the stranger, or a misinterpretation of the stranger. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which seems valid to me. I don't know. What else is there to... Obviously, I'm a little bit pressed for time, ladies and gentlemen, so this is going to be a short episode, although it's just a sample chapter, so I suppose that's okay. Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on before we signed off?
As I said, it is pretty much a mood setter, because Martin also very quickly in deficiency dispels with any notions one might have had about the nature of the Golden Company. They are not the good guys, because you see those Golden Company guys smirking about how they raped the young girls and the old, and like, "Oh, no, we only persuaded them." So you don't even get the idea to say this is a disciplined force and they don't do stuff like that. It is always the same, which is of course a message that we have come to repeatedly in our podcast. The Game of Thrones, when it is played, no matter who plays it, no matter where it is played, the effect is always the same.
Sounds about right, and a good note to end on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you everybody for listening to this most unexpected episode. I didn't know when we woke up this morning that we would be doing this, so it was exciting, and I guess, it's just fun to be back in this version of this world, in pure Absolutely. George R. R. Martin, A Song of Ice and Fire land. As much as I like the show, and as much as I really enjoyed the World of Ice and Fire and the novellas and stuff, I do enjoy these sample chapters, because it reminds me the level of detail and there's the unique Martin-esque prose. It's something that has obviously meant a great deal to me, or I wouldn't be talking to you about it. So it was fun. I hope, I know I enjoyed it.
I can only agree here. And before anyone's asking, yes, we will do an episode about the show, but not just yet.
Yes, yes.
So keep your feet still for a little while. We will come to it.
Yep.
And I guess as a little spoiler, this will likely be the first time that we really disagree about it. So keep your eyes peeled, or your ears, or whatever.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. And as we sign off, I just want to remind you that if you like the podcast, you're welcome to subscribe using any amount you so choose at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. Tell your friends, tell your neighbors, tell anybody who's interested in the show or the books that hasn't heard of us. The word of mouth means a great deal. And I guess that's it. So thank you for listening.
Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.